Well, good morning. This is Barry Odell with the Church of Christ at Mammoth Spring Facebook page. It's Wednesday morning, October 18th, 2023. Hope everybody's doing all right today. We are in the book of Zechariah, and we're ready for chapter 4. If you've been following along, this is the 28th video in our series on the minor prophets, and we're working our way through the prophet Zechariah. We know that he's doing his work about 520 years B.C., post-Babylonian captivity, reconstruction of Jerusalem, rebuilding of the temple, and he's contemporary with Haggai. Good morning, Debbie, Gail, Janie, others who are joining on, and of course there are those who watch on the nearchurches.com Facebook page. If you guys have any questions or comments while we're going through, don't hesitate to put them in the comment section, and I will acknowledge them when I see them. Zechariah is a book of 8 visions. We've been talking about those, and today, in chapters 4 and 5, we're going to deal with visions 5, 6, and 7. I don't want to get those numbers mixed up. Chapters 4 and 5, visions numbers 5, 6, and 7. And as I've said several times through Zechariah, it's very similar to the book of Revelation in your New Testament. Good morning, Anna. Very similar to Revelation because you have apocalyptic language, symbols, numbers, animals, a lot of prophecy. The book of Zechariah, okay, it's one of the minor prophets. It's only 14 chapters. It's one of the longer books of the minor prophets, but it's extremely messianic. Typically, for me, when I think of a messianic prophet, I think of Isaiah. Isaiah has a lot of prophecies about Jesus and the kingdom, the church, things like this. But man, Zechariah is right up there with Isaiah in terms of its messianic prophecies. Good morning, Lyle. Thank you, Debbie, for sharing. All right, so it's an interesting book. Most of it is dealing with issues of their day, things that the Jews rebuilding the temple and the city are dealing with, but there is a lot of prophecy looking forward to the coming of Christ. All right, chapter 4 is vision number 5. All right. Now the angel who talked with me came back and wakened me as a man who was wakened out of his sleep, and he said to me, "What do you see?" So again, this is Ezekiel, Daniel, Zechariah, Revelation. You have all of these symbols and dreams and visions and angels, messengers, and we have to work our way through it. Hey, David, good to see you. One thing I say, whether I'm teaching Revelation or Zechariah or Ezekiel, things like this, don't get lost in the symbolism. Allow the Bible to define the symbols for you. Sometimes it does that. Sometimes it doesn't do that. So, anyway, he's wakened out of his sleep. As a man who is wakened out of his sleep, what do you see? Well, there's a lampstand of solid gold with a bowl on top of it, and on the stand, 7 lamps with 7 pipes to the 7 lamps. We might have different visions of what that might look like in our head, but it's a source of light. All right, ultimately, that's what we're dealing with here. In this vision, Zechariah sees a source of light. 2 olive trees are by it. One at the right of the bowl, and the other at its left. So I answered and spoke to the angel who talked with me, saying, "What are these, my lord?" Don't you know? No, I don't know. That's why I'm asking. Verse 5. So he answered and said to me, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel." Now Zerubbabel, in Zechariah's day, was appointed by Persia, I guess you would say, to serve as the governor of Judea, the governor of Judah, rather. The monarchy's over. That ended with the last few kings there. Second Chronicles 35 and 36, Jeremiah chapter 52, Coniah. The very tail end of the monarchy ended prior to Babylonian captivity in 586. So now the dominant world empire is determining who's going to be, who's going to govern the land there in Judah. Hey, Mr. Raymond, good to see you. Well, it's Zerubbabel. So God is speaking to Zerubbabel, and he says, "Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you shall become a plain." I think that's simply, again, symbolic language. There's something standing in Zerubbabel's way, but it's going to be flattened out. It's any obstacle that may come. Now, contextually, the obstacle that was standing in the way of Zerubbabel. Remember, we've talked about this. Their task was to rebuild the temple, but they stopped because the Samaritan people, this is Ezra chapter 4, caused it to stop. They persecuted, they troubled the Israelites, they troubled the Jewish people, and they stopped building the temple for 16 years. And I think that's what we're dealing with here in Zechariah chapter 4. There's a mountain in front of him, but it's going to become a plain. And he shall bring forth the capstone with shouts of grace, grace to it. In other words, Zerubbabel, governor, whatever task is set before you, which again would be the construction of the temple or reconstruction of the temple, the obstacles are going to be taken out of the way. This is a source of light. Okay, you have this lampstand, the bowl of oil, the bowls of oil, the trees that are providing the oil for the lamp. There's a light burning here, all right? The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of the temple. That's Ezra chapter 3. His hand shall also finish it. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. For who has despised the day of small things? That's an interesting verse. I've heard a lot of sermons over the years based on Zechariah 4:10. Who has despised the day of small things? So think about, for example, the parables of Jesus. One of the parables of Jesus is referred to as the parable of the mustard seed. In Matthew chapter 13, Mark chapter 4, I don't know if it's any, maybe Luke chapter 8, I don't know. Anyway, the mustard seed, Jesus makes the point, it's the smallest of all seeds, but when it comes forth, it becomes a great bush. It becomes a great source of provision and protection for birds of the air. Well, Jesus' point is the kingdom of heaven is likened unto this. It's going to begin small. The church began relatively as a small entity just in the city of Jerusalem with about 3,000 people on the day of Pentecost, and they were all Jewish. But in time, that's going to grow, and many people will be able to come to it. And I think of Nebuchadnezzar's vision in Daniel chapter 2, where he saw that great image, and there was a stone cut out of the mountain that struck that image in the feet and destroyed it. But then that stone, which is representative of the kingdom of Christ, grew and filled the whole earth. So this idea here, Zechariah 4:10, who has despised the day of small things? This post-captivity temple is rather insignificant in size-wise in comparison with Solomon's temple. But that's not a bad thing. They're getting back to God's work. They've been returned to the land. Back to verse 10 now. For these seven rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of Judah. Okay, so these seven, you go back to chapter 4 and verse 2, and it talks about seven on the stand, seven lamps with seven pipes of seven lamps. So remember, don't get lost in the vision. Don't get lost in the images and trying to figure out every particular detail. The overarching detail is there's a source of light in Jerusalem. Zerubbabel's there. The temple's going to be rebuilt. Don't get discouraged because it's smaller than Solomon's temple. All right? They are the eyes of the Lord, which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. So that tells us, there you go. There's the biblical text defining what the symbols represent. Verse 11, then I answered and said to him, what are these two olive trees at the right and left, at the right of the lampstand and at its left? And I further answered and said to him, what are these two olive branches that drip into the receptacles of the two golden pipes from which the golden oil drains? Do you not know? No, I don't. Verse 14, these are the two anointed ones who stand beside the Lord of the whole earth. All right, so these symbols are not particularly defined. The two anointed ones, verse 14, well, what does that represent? The two olive trees that stand at the right and the left of this lampstand that Zechariah sees in his vision. I'll give you my opinion on it, but I can't be dogmatic in it. I think contextually, the lampstands would be Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah, and Joshua, the high priest. Joshua's going to come out a little bit later in more detail in this book. But these are the sources of leadership in Judah at this time as the temple's being rebuilt, as the city's being reconstructed. Well, they're two anointed ones. Exodus chapter 30 talks about the priesthood, okay, the Levitical priesthood. Of course, at that time it starts with Aaron. But the Levitical priesthood, if you're going to be in that, you have to be anointed. Kings We're anointed, okay, leaders of the people. Zerubbabel is the leader of Judah at this time. He would be one of these anointed ones. Joshua is the high priest. He would be one of the anointed ones too. These are the sources of light. I know that there's another view of what these two anointed ones are of Zechariah 4:14. Some say, hey, good morning, Connie. Some say it might be representative of Zechariah and Haggai. Because if you go, and I'll just do this real quickly. I'll flip back here to Ezra chapter 5. As this work is going on in the city and on the temple, Ezra and Nehemiah are God's prophets. A prophet is anointed by God. Let's see. Ezra chapter 5. Well, Ezra chapter 4 ends with the work on the temple ceasing for 16 years. Then you turn the page to Ezra chapter 5, and it says, then the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophets, prophesied to the Jews who were in the land of Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. So Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, rose up and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. So whoever these two anointed ones are in Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 14, it would make sense to either be Joshua and Zerubbabel, the governor and the high priest, or Haggai and Zechariah. Two sources, all four of these individuals are sources of light, sources of leadership. They're anointed by God. So frankly, it doesn't matter if you think it's the governor and the high priest or the two prophets. This is just Zechariah seeing a vision. And I would say this vision number 5 here throughout chapter 4 is a vision of encouragement. There's light. This is a day the temple's being rebuilt. Don't despise it. Good things are going on here. I think that's the main point of chapter 4. Chapter 5, you've got two visions. Vision 6 is the first 4 verses, and then vision 7 is the last 5 or 6 verses here. I turned and raised my eyes and saw there a flying scroll, very similar to something Ezekiel saw. Ezekiel, what is it, chapters 2 and 3, Ezekiel saw a scroll. Revelation chapters 4 and 5, John saw a scroll in the hand of God on the throne. Well, Zechariah sees a scroll. This is representative of a revelation from God, something being revealed by him. I see a flying scroll. Its length is 20 cubits and its width 10 cubits. So our language, that would approximately be 30 feet by 15 feet. That's a big piece of paper. All right, that's a big scroll. Then he said to me, this is the curse that goes out over the face of the whole earth. Every thief shall be expelled according to this side of the scroll, and every perjurer shall be expelled according to that side of it. So 30 feet by 15 feet, and the message is no thieves and no one who swears falsely. Okay, no, the New King James says perjurer, but if you go on and read verse 4, it tells us what that means. One who swears falsely by my name. And so essentially what vision number 6 is dealing with here is that sin will not go unpunished. Now Israel, the Jewish people already know that. All right, they've been in Babylon for 70 years. They know God will not tolerate sin forever because they just suffered for theirs. And so again, to me, this is another encouraging message to Haggai, Zechariah, to Joshua and Zerubbabel, to the people of Israel at large who are doing their work. God will not allow sin to go unpunished. So let's think about that for just a minute. All right, so thou shalt not steal. Exodus 20:15. That's one of the Ten Commandments. Swear falsely. So let me flip back here real quick to the law. I think it's Leviticus chapter 19 and verse. Now, what verse is it? I thought it was verse 27, but it's not. Anyway, Leviticus chapter 19 talks about not swearing falsely by the Lord's name. There it is, Leviticus 19:11. You shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another, and you shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane the name of the Lord your God. I am the Lord. You know, one of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. You know, classically, I've always heard that defined as don't say things like, oh my God, or use Jesus' name flippantly, like people in anger, you know, say, you know, exclaim, Jesus Christ, things like that. And I think there's some truth to that, that could be what that means. But I tend more to believe that taking the Lord's name in vain, the word vain means empty, would be using it in an empty manner. And I think Zechariah chapter 5 and verse 4 lays that out. It shall enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name. It's kind of like what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 and verse... Well, it's in Matthew chapter 5. Can't think of the verse off the top of my head, but let your yes be yes and your no, no. Any more than that's from the evil one. To me, that's what it means to take the Lord's name in vain, to use it in an empty way. The Pharisees were condemned because they would swear by one thing and keep their word, but they would swear by something that they would claim to be lesser so they could break their word. And Jesus says, no, if you give your word, whether it's yes or whether it's no, then your word has to stand. And so that's vision number 6 here in chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. Sin is not going to go unpunished. And for whatever reason, these two sins are singled out, stealing and swearing by God's name falsely. But I think it covers, in general, all sin. God doesn't permit sin to go unpunished. Now, it may not be punished in the moment. We understand that. And it certainly... Think of the history of Israel and how many years God tolerated their unfaithfulness. And I don't mean just years, I mean centuries. Now, they were punished throughout that period of time, but in a variety of ways. But ultimately, it came to an end in both Assyrian captivity for northern Israel and Babylonian captivity for southern Israel or Judah. Sin is not going to go unpunished. Think of the judgment day. Sin's not going to go unpunished. All right, vision number 7 here, chapter 5, beginning in verse 5. The angel who talked with me came out and said to me, lift up your eyes now and see what this is that goes forth. Well, it's a basket. Zechariah sees a basket. It has a lid for it, according to verse 6, a lid made of lead. Rather, that's verse 7. And there's a woman sitting inside the basket. So this is quite an interesting vision. He says, this is wickedness, verse 8. This vision that John, I keep wanting to say John because the book of Revelation is so similar in a lot of ways. This vision that Zechariah sees is of a basket with a lid and a woman is inside of it, and it's representative of wickedness. This is wickedness, verse 8. And he thrust her down into the basket and threw the lead cover over its mouth. Well, then he sees two other women who have wings, and they come and they pick the basket up, and they carry the basket away to the land of Shinar, verse 13. That's Babylon. That would represent the heathen nations. When it is ready, the basket will be set there on its base. I think simply the meaning of this vision here, and it's in connection with vision number 6 in chapter 5 and verses 1 through 4, is the removal of sin from God's people. So like yesterday, for instance, we talked about the fact that the priesthood was defiled. Was that Zechariah chapter 3? That's that vision in the first part of chapter 3. Well, the priesthood was cleansed. And you can go back to Ezra and Nehemiah and read about those things happening in real time, whereas Zechariah is given a vision I don't think the word crazy is the right word to use, but that's one I'm going to go with for the moment. Kind of a crazy vision, and that's what this is here. A woman in a basket and two other women with wings carries it off to a foreign land. It's simply representative of the fact that in the restoration of the land, in Israel's return to God, sin is going to be gotten rid of. It's not as predominant among God's people as it was. We know they're not perfect, obviously. And the book of Malachi is going to deal with that. Malachi is even beyond the book of Zechariah, time-wise, closer to the life of Christ. But anyway, the removal of sin from among God's people. That's what the meaning of this vision is here in Zechariah 5, verses 7 through 11. Not really hard to understand. If you know the history, if you know Ezra and Nehemiah and what's going on, and you keep the book of Zechariah within its historical context, that's one of the biggest things to help you understand this type of literature. What is going on in that day? Why would Zechariah be seeing visions like this? Ezra and Nehemiah. You've got to read those books if you want to understand this one. That's it, guys. There's not a lot of great explanation here. It's interesting. There's no question about that. It's an interesting passage to read, these visions. And yet the meaning is pretty straightforward. And that's what I've said. I talked about this a bit Sunday in the Sunday morning sermon, talking about Israel and, you know, the war over there that's going on right now and end times stuff that people want to preach during times like this. And one of the things I said was, the Bible's not a mystery book trying to trick you. It's really not. You have a book like Zechariah that is indeed interesting and has a lot of odd visions in it, but you have the historical books of Ezra and Nehemiah that you can read to help you understand precisely what's going on here. Same thing's true with Revelation. Same thing's true with Ezekiel, Daniel. God's not trying to fool us. He's not trying to trick us or keep us in the dark. We just have to. And I think this is, and I've said this a lot over the, particularly over the last couple of years, one of the things that's missing the most when people approach the Bible is common sense. It's like they approach the Bible and they have this feeling that there has to be something more to it than what's actually there. Well, maybe there doesn't. Maybe there's a pretty straightforward explanation. Maybe we don't have to come up with some grand modern-day meaning of a symbol in Revelation or of a symbol in Zechariah. Maybe it actually meant something to those people that they could understand even better than we today can understand it. That's it, guys. I don't have anything else. Three visions, pretty straightforward. Chapter 4 is all encouraging. And I would really say chapter 5 is all encouraging. Visions number 6 and 7, because sin will not go unpunished. First 4 verses. And then the last few verses of chapter 5, sin's not going to dwell among God's people. That's not a bad thing.